The title of Dr. Graham Finlay's talk is Genetics, Evolution, Cancer, Suffering, and God.
So really it looks like I'm going to talk about absolutely everything tonight, but I won't be able to. As Peter said, my background is in cancer. I am certainly not an evolutionary biologist, but my reading of cancer genetics led me, almost ineluctably, into reading and appreciating the force of the genetics which underlies cancer, evolution. So I'll start off today by discussing cancer genetics and then working back, cancer genetics, then working back to biological genetics, the big picture. And then we'll note there's a very marked tension here. Evolutionary genetics has produced the glorious wonder of the diversity of living things. And Christians can think, wow, isn't God wonderful? But if the principles are the same, and the very wonderful way that life has been produced is also the same way that cancers are produced, and viruses and pathogens, then we've got to ask a question, well, how come this is all the one world that God has created? So let's get underway. And what I'm saying today is all pretty recent. Just about all the data I'm producing today is post my book because of the dramatic advances in the way DNA is sequenced. So let's start off with one story. We'll talk about esophageal carcinoma just briefly. Now, I'm cheating here. There is a sample of esophageal carcinoma, or although it's the wrong sort for the purists, I don't have at least one Medicare. But there it is. You can see that rough area here in the esophagus. There's a stomach just down here. And esophageal carcinoma, in fact, the adenocarcinoma variety, is increasing in frequency in developed industrialized countries at an alarming rate. It's something in the environment, something in our lifestyle that people don't understand. But this isn't a cancer talk per se. Here is a study where people have used high throughput DNA sequences to look at the evolution of disease in the esophagus and how that has followed a series of steps. So we start here with, that shouldn't have come. With the progenitor cells. And here are five different biopsies of a progenitor lesion called Barrett's esophagus, which is just a chronic inflammatory condition in the esophagus, really resulting from burping up stomach acid. And then, I'm just mastering this machine. That then leads to a set of more sinister conditions in the lining of the esophagus. A series of high-grade dysplasias. So when a pathologist sees this, he or she thinks, this isn't cancer, but the cells are looking nasty. They are changing. They're becoming precancerous. And then finally, at the very bottom, adenocarcinoma appears, and that's this very lethal cancer which is causing so much concern in industrialized countries. Now, I've indicated here some of the mutations which occur sequentially during the development of this condition. So first of all, up here, we have a deletion of the CDKN2A gene. This is the very important tumor suppressor gene. And we know that it's at the very beginning of the whole sequence because that same mutation, just follow the color code, is there in Barrett's esophagus, which is really just a benign condition. It's not very nice, but it's just benign. In the high-grade dysplasias, and also in adenocarcinoma, which is the lethal thing. So every sample, every biopsy you take and you sequence, you find that the cells all have that same mutation. An ineluctable conclusion, that occurred initially at the start, and all the cells which possess that mutation are descended from the one cell in which that mutation occurred. It's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? A tumor can be something big and horrible and nasty and contain 10 to the 10 cells, 10,000 million cells. But when they all have the same mutation, we know they're derived from the one cell in which that unique mutation occurs. And then we can follow, other mutations. Here are two more mutations which occurred in the high-grade dysplasia, but nowhere else. That dysplastic patch seems to have been a bit of an end of the road sort of thing. It didn't come into anything. Here are three more conditions. They occurred in all of the high-grade dysplasias and in the adenocarcinoma. So we can say that all these lesions were derived from the one cell in which each of these occur. So again, following mutations helps you to see how the tumour has evolved and diversified. And then at the bottom, the adenocarcinoma follows from these different mutations here. These mutations are characteristic of all the frankly malignant cells. So you can see how mutation A established that all of the cells in a lesion come from the same progenitor, one cell, and B, how subsequent mutations allow you to map up the different trees, the different branches which form in this tree-like evolutionary structure. Here's another example. Okay, you've seen that slide 5 times already. Sorry about that. These are nasty prostate cancer cells. I don't know why they're green and blue. Red, they've been stained for probably epithelial and mesenchymal proteins. And the blue in them are their nasty-looking cancer nuclei. So the next study is prostate cancer. How does prostate cancer develop? And it shows a similar sort of branching. So here again, heaps of high-technology, sequencing of DNA. The technology leaves me behind. But here are a whole bunch of mutations. This fusion gene, an RB1 mutation, a TP53 loss of heterozygosity, a RUNX2 frameshift, and all of the cells in this prostate cancer have those 5 mutations. Again, the conclusion, they all derive from one precursor. All those cells come from the single cells in which these occur. Then here's another mutation in the androgen receptor, probably giving rise to patient failure, and then a famous MYC amplification occurred at this precursor because all these individual metastases show the same mutation. So once again, it tells us about progenitors and descendant cells and the way that sequential mutations enable us to understand branching as tumors develop. So that's just setting the baseline of how cancer evolution reflects and uses the same mechanisms as what I'll describe later, biological evolution. And then I want to change tack slightly and talk about another sort of mutations which occur in cancers. And these are called jumping genes or retrotransposons. Now, it's an amazing thing. Every cell of our bodies has 2 meters of DNA, which is about that much if you took either wrist and gave a neck. 2 meters of DNA. Fully 50% of our DNA is composed of bits of DNA called jumping genes. And they're just little parasites. They live a life of their own. They jump around in our DNA. They've accumulated over the millions of years of our ancestry so that half our DNA is sequences derived from these jumping genes. And the way they work is something like this. You have here we go again. That one. An original parent jumping gene or transposable element. That's in the DNA. It's copied into a molecule called RNA. The RNA, is made into a couple of proteins, an enzyme. These join together and come to another part somewhere else in the genome where the RNA is pasted back into a daughter transposable element. So it's a copy and paste. You who use Word or whatever, copy and paste. That's how these jumping genes have proliferated to such incredible numbers in our DNA. They've copied and pasted themselves so that we've got millions, literally millions of copies of these jumping genes littering our genomes. And it's that much, fully 50% of our DNA. Probably 67% or more if you use more sensitive technologies. So here's a recent study looking at one particular colon cancer. And so here's another colon cancer from the Auckland Medical School Museum. Here's normal colon. You see it thinning here, and you get down to this, and you see this ugly, horrible mass which is occluding the colon and invading the wall. Lethal colon cancer. And that's something that Aussies and Kiwis share in common. We have the highest rates of colon cancer in the world. So it's an environmental thing. It's probably the way we eat. Now, a group wanted to ask the question, a research group, what's the role of jumping genes in cancers? And they were able to show that a number of human cancers arise at least partially because of these spontaneously proliferating jumping genes which just happen to occupy our DNA and jump around them. And this is a very cunning, idea which I borrowed from somewhere else, where all the human chromosomes are put in a circle, so you can see the relationship between the different chromosomes. From the longest one, which is chromosome 1, to the shortest one, which is chromosome 22, and then the X chromosome and the Y chromosome. So they're basically arranged in length, like St. Paul's letters in the New Testament. Not a very good way of classifying things, but convenient, I suppose. And in this colon cancer, they were able to show, and a small number of others, but here's a particular case, there was a jumping gene living on chromosome 17, and it was spawning offspring around the genome of this patient to chromosome 4, chromosome 5, 8, 9, and 11. Chromosome 5 is particularly interesting because it's known that this chromosome, there is a very important gene which acts as a gatekeeper for colorectal cancer. This is the APC gene, which is mutated in just about all human colorectal cancers. So this jumping gene, which originated there, the parent lives there, spawned a daughter copy, which just happened to go into part of this APC gene, and it inactivated it, it scrambled it. So the APC gene was scrambled, and that seemed to be the initial trigger which allowed this colon cancer to develop. Now, every cancer cell, as far as could be told from the sequencing, had that mutation. So all of those cancer cells were derived from one cancer cell which had this mutation. And here is the actual mutation. Here we have normal cells down here, and they have a sequence somewhere in this gene, just there, CACT, blah, 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 TTT. And the enzymatic machinery of this jumping gene just picked that sequence and inserted the jumping gene, called a line 1 element, into that sequence in such a way that the target was duplicated on either side. Whoops, I've gone back this time. So there is your new jumping gene, which is actually several thousand of those letters long. I didn't say it, but these are the genetic letters, A, C, T, and G, which form our genome. So that's the exact science in which the enzymes of this jumping gene inserted a copied version, scrambling a gene and starting off the process which led to cancer evolution. Now, I mustn't go too long today, but here is just another example. This is one looking at metastatic, I think it's prostate cancer, into the liver. And again, here are our patterns of chromosomes, and here are two jumping genes. One's copied itself from blip, there to there. Another has copied itself from there to there. And you find these two mutations in each of three different secondary tumours in the liver. So the conclusion, those three secondary tumours were all derived from one cell back here, which was a progenitor of all the three different tumours which were spawned from the first one. And secondly, you can find here's another series of jumping genes, four at this time, one, two, three, four, and that characterizes these two liver metastases. So these jumping gene events occurred after this one, before this one, and was a precursor of these two tumors. So again, you can lay out the history of a tumor on the basis of the order in which these jumping genes or other mutations occur. And I've given you other examples, and maybe it'll get a bit tedious if I work through them all. Here's a final example. There's a nasty, grotty pancreatic carcinoma. Here's a pancreas that's totally infiltrated by a tumour. And here people have found lots of jumping genes, and these are the target genes which the jumping genes have interrupted. So here are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 genes, and we know that they are occurred in progenitors of all the cancer cells because they are there in every cell. And again, you can follow through the branching, showing that there is another set of jumping events here, another set of jumping events here, but you can order them according to the number of metastatic tumour nodules which have. The other branches were derived from other mutations which aren't particularly interesting. So such retrotransposers are somatic. In other words, they occur in bodies, in people's bodies, as they're growing up and they're growing older. But others occur in the germline. What happens if a retrotransposon jumps into an egg cell or a sperm cell? Then your kids can get it. And it can be passed on from generation to generation, and it can then mark not a lineage of tumour cells, but a lineage of people. Here's a very interesting study that came out last year, looking at low-frequency jumping genes, in other words, ones which have occurred very recently in human history, and seeing if they fell into different populations. And the answer was, yes, in most cases, if you look at jumping genes which are present at low frequency in the human population, you can just about locate a person as to where he or she came from. For example, a series of jumping genes is particular to Japanese, or Han Chinese in Beijing, or Han Chinese in the South, or Vietnamese, or other Chinese. So they can map out the evolution, if you like, of human populations. Others can pick up different European groups, and others pick up African groups. In fact, there's just one which is out of place. But you see here the branches are very short, meaning that there are not many mutations involved, so it's easy to get those wrong. But the bottom line is, jumping genes in the germline can map out relationships among human populations. So it's analogous to what happens in tumours. And if we go on, we can look beyond the human race, and we can look at other species. Now, this is a 2013 paper, so it was just too late for my book. But this indicates the rate of technological progress. Here is a study where they did whole genome sequencing of 10 humans, 10 chimps, 10 bonobos, which are pygmy chimps, 10 gorillas, and 10 orangutans. And they were looking for new jumping genes of two classes, line 1 and ALU. Those and those, line 1 and ALU. And they found all of these, which hadn't been found in earlier studies using more primitive sort of year 2000 type techniques. So here are 5,000 new line 1 jumping genes. sitting in the DNA of humans, chimps, bonobos, and gorillas. So they're there in our DNA, in all of us. They're common to all of us. These aren't divided according to population. But they're also there in the two species of chimps and in gorillas. So by the exact analogy that a tumour biologist has, these 5,000 new markers demonstrate in a very conclusive way that humans, chimps, bonobos and gorillas are descended from the precursors in which those particular jumping genes occurred. And if you look at ALU elements, there's another 2,800 which are also common to humans, chimps and gorillas. Then you can look a little more recent, and you have hundreds more which are common to humans, chimps and bonobos, but not gorillas. And then a lot more which are common to humans and each individual lineage. So from the tumour type logic we've used right up till now, we can say with absolute confidence that humans and those other eight great ape species derive from common ancestors. So this doesn't use any kind of different weird Darwinian logic. It's the same basic logic which is inherent to genetics and which I just described as indicating the evolution of tumours. And here's an example, okay? So this is one of those line 1 elements, of which we have 500,000 in our DNA, so they occupy 15% of our DNA. So 15% of 2 metres is 30 centimetres. Okay, so 30 centimetres of our DNA are occupied by line 1 elements. And here you see some species which have been found to show the unoccupied target site. This is the original target site before the jumping gene leaped in and disrupted it, including, fascinatingly, a horse, which is a rather remote relation from us. But here, tarsiers show the target site duplication. Yes, a few changes. A lot of histories occurred. Marmosets, which are New World monkeys. Macaques and baboons, which are Old World monkeys. And orangutans, chimps and human beings, which are hominoids, apes, not great apes. So here we've gone way back in history and found jumping genes, very ancient, which demonstrate that all the apes, the Old World monkeys and the New World monkeys and the tarsiers are descended ultimately from the single cell in which that marked in green jumping gene occurred. It's extraordinary evidence. Remember, DNA is the information molecule. I don't have anything against my colleagues who study fossils or geology, but information is present in abundance in our DNA. It provides a record of its generation. And here's another one. Don't want to get tedious, but also demonstrating common ancestry from humans, monkeys and tarsiers. And people have... This is another recent study from 2015 where people have just taken a series of ALU elements of different subtypes and they've mapped them. And this time we go back not only to Old World monkeys and tarsiers, but they found some of them are present in lemurs and bush babies, which are prosimians. And so these four elements, which are shared by all of these species, arose in a primate ancestor. There's a philosopher here, they'll laugh at me. It is convincing evidence that all of the primates are derived from a common ancestor. Right? You can see that? In this, it's basic to genetics. And again, we've got more ALU elements, or may have been some of the same ones, which are shared by tarsiers, not lemurs and bush babies, and so up the series. But it's a consistent pattern showing the order in which branching occurred. And this is just a particular example. There are other classes of jumping genes which are even older. And here is a MER element, mammalian-wide interspersed repeat, And you can see that the DNA is now getting really ragged. Well, no wonder, because this is really old. And you can find the same Mer element not only in primates, but in horses, pigs, bats, and foxes, which are known as Laurasia therians, elephants, manatees, and garden moles, which are Afrotherians, and aardvarks and armadillos. And I've written in bold bases which are invariant for all of those species, despite the vast genetic history which separates them. So here is the jumping gene, which demonstrates that all Eutherian mammals came back way back from all Eutherians from a single cell. It doesn't mean there was only one species there, one individual at that time. It just means that over evolutionary time, all the other lineages died out. And we're just left with that one lineage. Obviously, there will be lots more Mer elements which did die out too. It's never made the grave. But here we have a Mer element from way back, which we share with flying foxes, demonstrating common ancestry. Now, fascinatingly, there has been no study looking at Mer elements in terms of, no systematic study in terms of mammalian evolution, probably because they are getting so tacit. But you'd expect them to be tacit. Their bases change because we are now talking about going back to the common Eutherian ancestor, maybe 18 million years of evolution. But you can still be tacit. And here, oh, there's one more, a Mer element, that's from the paper this year. Sorry, I don't have a reference, there's no room. But this is how far genetic sequencing's coming. Here you've got something like 25 mammalian species, and they all have another Mer element in common. You can see the similarity, again, bold type is where pretty much they all show the Mer V. And this includes the platypus. So there's something for you Aussies. We are all descended from the same ancestor as the platypus. So I'm an Aussie too. You know what? Okay. So let's move on. Maybe I should skip this. Because I'm not with it. But this does produce a problem. As I mentioned at the start. When we think of the evolution of life, it's glorious. You look at the profusion of life in the Great Barrier Reef or tropical forests, and Christians can think, wow, isn't this world constituted, aren't the laws of nature constituted in such a way as to produce this glorious diversity of living things? But then the question comes, hey, you told us that cancer follows the same genetic principle. And the implication is, well, if God is responsible for the good stuff, is he not responsible for the bad stuff? How can Christians praise God for the beauty of the diversity of life when it looks as if those same mechanisms are at work in the development of cancer? So there's something here that is urgently in need of addressing, and I can't give you the whole answer, and I'm sure the theologians among you will have something to say, but let's work through some suggestions as to how we can worship God for creation and yet retain intellectual and spiritual integrity. Oh, that's just thinking of cancer cells again, the nasty rotten things, which are part of creation. The first thing I want to say is, and I've got about 8 points to quickly work through, the issue does not arise only with biology. So this is part of the broader question, and we just need to set it in context. So the wonder of the human mind, which produces saints and artists and the marvelous things of human history, of human culture, has also produced the lowest levels of degradation and hatefulness and brutality. So God is responsible for the saints, yes, but he is also responsible for the murderer and the saviors. God is the creator of Hitler. He is also the creator of Karl Barth, who led the movement against Hitler. So the problem is not unique to biology. We do have to look out at our glorious creation and say, yes, Lord God, there is glory in it. There is glory in humanity, but there is also degradation as well. We can think about Israel. And I mentioned in my talk on Tuesday how evolution must be seen as history. It's not creation. It's not the same sort of category as creation at all. It's history, which is why there can be no conflict between evolution and creation. So we can compare evolution, which is history, with the history of Israel. And obviously Israel forms its history forms our Old Testament. And we see in the creation of a new nation from slavery a wonderful creative work of God. A brilliant creative work that Christians can worship for. But we also see in the creation, in the history of Israel, not only saints, the Isaiah, Jeremiah, the great prophet, but we see Israel. Glorious creation of God. Yes, the Bible explicitly calls Israel a creation of God. We find the utmost degradation, which led ultimately, according to the prophets, to the destruction, the total elimination, first of Samaria, the northern kingdom, and then of Jerusalem. So there's grandeur and horror in Israel. And of course we get a sense of that as you read the Old Testament. And what about the church? The Bible very explicitly calls the church a creation of God. In Ephesians chapter 2, it's a wonderful creation. As far as the Christians are concerned, it's a glorious creation of God. And yet we look at the history of the church and we find schism, we find unfaithfulness, we find the importation of all sorts of horrible and ugly practices, and we think, God is the creator of the church, but look at it. There is so much which compromises and fails. And of course, each one of us is a creation of God. Very clear. Psalm 3, we are all creations of God, capable of the highest nobility, but often practicing the lowest of degradation. Well, one way of looking at this, and I think it's a good start, comes from the Anglican theologian and physical scientist, Professor Polkinghorne. So we'll just quote from Professor Polkinghorne and take the good out of what he says. Polkinghorne says, I think the only possible solution to this ambiguity of God's creation lies in a variation of the free will defense applied now to the whole created world. One might call it the free process defense. In his great act of creation, I believe that God allows the physical world to be itself in the independence which is love's gift of freedom to the one beloved. And I think we've got a great start here. God, in his love, has gifted his creation, including us, with freedom. And we talk about the free will defense. But Polkinghorne extends that and says, well, maybe we should think about atoms and molecules and viruses and DNA and include that in that same umbrella understanding. Here is a free process. God, in his gift of love to his creation, has made it able to enjoy its own authentic history. It is not a mechanism. It is not a puppet on strings. God, in effect, has limited himself by allowing his creation freedom. So I think there's a lot of very helpful stuff in here, but I would question one thing, and I'll come back to that. God allows the physical world to be itself. Continuing with John Polkinghorne, God no more expressly wills the growth of a cancer than he expressly wills the acts of a murderer, but he allows both to happen. He is not the puppet master of either men or matter. And John Polkinghorne's account. So again, I think there's a lot of truth in that. God, in his love, gives us freedom. And like Isis, he is not a coercive God. And like the Inquisition, it does not lose your head or be baptized. He gives us freedom to go our own way. We might have liked him to have blocked Hitler in his tracks, but then how often would he have had to interfere in my life to stop things which scar my memory? But again, just one problem. He still talks about allowing. And that worries me. Because the third point I want to raise is, then this comes from Adria Koenig, who was my really inspiring theology lecturer when I was doing my degree. If God allows sin and suffering, he remains answerable for them. Now, that's really in your face, isn't it? He was an inspiring theologian, and this comes from the textbook he wrote for us. But I believe he's honest. If God allows sin and suffering, does not he remain answerable for them? Can we say that God allows it in love? Surely we don't allow our kids to harm themselves. We remain responsible if they do. So the free will defense, as Polkinghorne enunciated it, needs to be developed. And the first step, perhaps, is to go on again to compare the history of Israel, biblical history, with evolutionary history, and say God's relation with us, with people, and perhaps with brute matter, is covenantal. There are two parts. The relationship is asymmetrical, but nevertheless, there are two partners. I quote here from Jürgen Moltmann, and he says, starting down here halfway, before God the Creator, we and our descendants and all living things are partners in the same covenant. All living things are partners in God's covenant. So that's another fruitful way. I think once you appreciate that evolution is history, there is so much, I think, cross-fertilization with other histories, such as the history of Israel. And as God's history of Israel is a covenant, so perhaps God's relationship with molecules or thermodynamics or animals and plants and viruses or whatever is covenantal. God is the source. He promises the consummation, but he gives freedom so that the partner, you and me and DNA, can do its own thing without a finger poking God. Quote another more recent theologian, Richard Bauckham, whom I'm sure you've read and enjoyed. Animate creatures are suitable partners in a covenant. So I go a little beyond Richard Bauckham. I say, why animate creatures? Why not? Chemicals as well. Nucleic acid, DNA. Bauckham says, for the time being, the covenant God makes is with all living creatures, not just with humans. For it was only within this community of creatures that God has ever envisaged his human creatures living. So again, I think we can propose that as we look at the ambiguity of our world, it arises from a covenantal God who gives us the dignity and who enables even chemicals to do their own thing, to behave as they do in whatever chemical environment arises, because he is not a coercive God. We'll do that. So may we extend this, my comment. God acts in a covenantal way with all creation. He gives freedom to physical reality that he must respect. Which brings me to the next point. And for this, I'm leaning on a recent book, which came out in 2015, which I find very useful, called The Uncontrolling Love of God, by Thomas J. Urey. I don't agree with everything he says, mainly because I'm ignorant, but some of it's a little bit abstract. It's very readable, but I think it's a very helpful book because it takes us further than we've been so far. I warn you, it might be hard to get rid of because I think it sold out before publication. But I was very lucky to get it. He talks of the uncontrolling love of God and refers to it in terms of kenosis. Now, kenosis is a Greek word which we often just say is self-emptying. But he doesn't like that. I mean, how could God empty himself? I mean, it sounds like he's some sort of a tank. Maybe self-giving is a better word. And it comes from Paul's letter, St. Paul's letter to the Christians at Philippi. I'll just read you these few verses where Paul, possibly quoting an earlier hymn, talks about the work of Jesus, who Christians believe came from the Father, God himself, to redeem creation, humanity. Speaking of Jesus, Paul writes, "He always has a nature of God, but he did not think that by force he should try to remain equal with God. Instead of his own free will, he gave up all he had." Ekenosei. Self-giving. Self-emptying, if you will. "And took the form of a servant. He became a human being and appeared in human likeness. He was humble and walked the path of obedience all the way to death. His death on the cross. For this reason, God raised him to the highest place above and gave him the name that is greater than any other name. And so in honor of the name of Jesus, all beings in heaven, on earth, and in the world below will fall on their knees and will openly proclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father." So here is an amazing poem saying that God in Christ was kenotic, self-emptying, or preferably self-giving and others empowering. So Urd says, "Jesus' kenotic life and death reveal that God engages. If Jesus is the perfect representation of God, in fact God in human flesh, as Christians believe, Jesus' kenotic life and death reveals that God engages in self-giving, others empowering love." To continue, "To say kenosis is a necessary, eternal, and logically primary attribute of the divine nature means that God expresses kenosis inevitably. God must, in love, empower his creatures. He cannot interfere in a way which is manipulative or coercive. He is necessarily kenotic. He does not allow evil," coming back to allowing, "because he is necessarily a God who gives his creatures the dignity of their own track, their own existence, their own, the course of their own existence. Essential kenosis says that God's self-giving, others-empowering nature of love necessarily provides freedom, agency, self-organization, and law-like regularity to creation. Obviously, freedom to people, agency to animals, self-organization to plants or bacteria, law-like regularity to stars and atoms, whatever. God necessarily, out of his love, out of his valuation for his creation, gives that freedom. He will not coerce in order to achieve his purposes." I find that helpful. I find it. Maybe it doesn't answer all the questions, but it does help us to see that a God whose primary attribute is love gives freedom and does not withdraw that freedom either from simple people like I, or from DNA molecules in the colon of a human being. But this leads us to a new, I think, aspect. Where is God in all this? Okay, so he gives freedom to creation. Cancers develop. Wonderful creatures evolve. So what? The next point I think we need to say, and again I come back to my professor, Adrian Turney, it is of decisive significance that Old Testament history reveals the essence of history. And that history is genuine history. In other words, not a puppet, not something coerced and pre-programmed, but something which is authentic and which can work out its own course. So it's not a puppet show. It's a history in which two covenant partners have their own responsibility allocated to them respectively by God alone, but not executed by God alone. Now, here it is. This is important. The greater part of history of Israel, of the church, and the world, and here I interpolate, and of inanimate nature too, is in fact a violation of the will of God and has been other than he willed it to be. So yes, the genetics of cancer is part of the world he has created, but it is a violation of his will, even though he must give it freedom. So not everything that happens is the will of God, since a great many things occur which are against his will. The Bible abounds with things which are against God's will. This is the consequence of the covenant structure through which God deals with man, since through the covenant he gives man, humanity, the opportunity to make a substantial contribution to history. God has promised the consummation. He's promised it. But he's going to achieve it by wooing creation to himself, by working within it patiently and lovingly, and not by coincidence. Now let's have another biological deviation to bring me on to my next point. This is another absolutely extraordinary paper which came out, sorry I don't have a reference, after my book was published. This identifies, look at the very, very top, a hepatitis B virus. Now that's a nasty pathogenic virus. In humans, human hepatitis B virus is really the second major carcinogen behind tobacco. There are alien forms and they're pretty nasty too. And this research group has found an almost complete human hepatitis B virus, avian hepatitis B virus genome in the genomes of effectively all perching and songbirds. So, obviously, it's a long time ago, it's a bit ragged in places, there are some gaps, I don't know whether that's because of it, I think it's because of DNA deletions, but you can see that with all these birds, whether it's a sunbird or a rifleman or a kea from New Zealand, or a woodpecker or a buzzard or a vulture or a gull or a stork or a hoatzin or a wood pigeon or a sparrow or whatever, a kookaburra, they've all got that same signal of this pathogenic pathogenic virus in their DNA. So, I'm not talking about human evolution now, but now we know that all perching and songbirds are derived from a common ancestor. The one in which this vanishing, this unique mutational event took place, and the hepatitis virus got itself into the DNA of a germ cell. So, it's fascinating. But why do I bring this up? Because I want to talk about birds just for a moment. There is a verse in Matthew chapter 10 that says, not a sparrow falls to the ground without your father. That's what the Greek says. Human translators have rather loused it up. They said, not a sparrow falls to the ground without your father's permission. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without your father's will. Not a sparrow falls to the ground without your father's consent. That's my good news, by the way. They're all wrong. And this is me, speaking on the authority of Professor Koenig. He says, what the Greek says is not a sparrow falls to the ground without your father. The littlest bird falls to the ground and God is there. He is involved. He cares. He is empathetic. He is affected when the least of his little creatures suffer. So we see that God, whose primary nature is love, who gives creation its freedom, who sees things in creation which are contrary to his will, this God who is a source of joy, at the same time is affected, is present when a sparrow falls to the ground. God is involved in his children's distress. Maybe Psalm 115 verse 16. Precious to the Lord is the death of one of his people. Precious is a funny word, not all translations have it. Painful to God in the Good News Bible is the death of one of his children. In the Jerusalem Bible, costly to God is the death of one of his people. So although God must give freedom to his creation, when we get sick, Christian theology insists that God grieves with us. So we may come to two models of care. And this again comes from the pastoral heart of Professor Kirk. Just imagine a child being run over by a car. We can come to the child, to the grieving parents and say, I'm so sorry to hear what happened. But you know, God knows what he's doing. We can't understand the will of God. God sent this accident to bring good out of it. We may not know what it is now, but we will know one day why this happened. There was a purpose behind it. There is a purpose behind everything God does. Model one. Model two, I'm sorry to hear of the death of your child. I want to let you know that God is grieving with you. This hurts God to the core. It is totally contrary to his will. And God has protested against accidents like this at great cost. He has determined, he has vowed to extirpate from his creation the sorts of things that happen which has caused you this grief. Which do you think is the most answer? Which is the most true to God? I don't believe that God sends cancer. I don't believe that God sends accidents. But I do believe that God grieves with us in our grief. God is affected. Yes, God, the source of joy, is affected when we are sick, and when we suffer, and when we sin, and when we are outside of this. This is an amazing vision of an empathetic and involved God. Now, just moving on from cancer for a little bit. Some of the most moving poetry I have ever read has come from men who have seen the depths of human squalor. There's a wonderful piece of poetry by Edward Shalita, who was a padre in the First World War. He was there in the trenches. He saw the depths to which human beings could go. And yet he said, when I see such violence, the only thing that my faith can hang on to is a God who suffers with us. And part of the little poem he wrote, God of the Skies, and I changed it slightly to make the English more modern. The other gods were strong, but you were weak. They rode, but you did stumble to a throne. and to our wounds. Only your wounds can speak. No other God has wounds but you alone. No other God has wounds but you alone. Now, I said yesterday when I talked about creation, I think the Jewish vision of creation is one of the two greatest radical transformations of human being. I think the idea of the kenotic God, the God who comes into us and comes to us in the brokenness of Christ, that is the other greatest transformation. Kleroses in kenosis. There's another problem that comes from the same situation. In fact, I've got the words here. And this comes from Studdard Kennedy. Again, another chapter. First World War. Saw the swallow. Hung on to his faith through one thing. And that is that God in Christ had entered into our suffering. And he asks God the question that we've been asking this evening. And then in his next two verses, he comes to the two other models. Either God is an omni-God who is distant and remote, or else he is a God who cares for us. Every time a gene mutates and a sickness occurs, God is involved. Do you not heed the helpless sparrows falling? Can you not see the tears that women weep? Can you not hear your little children calling? Do you not watch over them as they sleep? Then, O my God, you are too great to love me. Since you do reign beyond the reach of tears, calm and serene as the cool stars above me, high and remote from human hopes and fears. That's one model. God, aren't you involved? Don't you care? Then you've got nothing to say to me. But the other model is this. Only in him can I find home to hide me, who on the cross was slain to rise again. Only with him, my comrade God beside me, can I go forth to war with sin and pain. I think as we look at the suffering in our lives, the hope we get is that God is implacably opposed to it and will work to destroy it and to renew all things. So God suffers for creation. He suffers with creation. He suffers for creation. God has entered into his creation, and his great purpose is that he will extirpate cancer and disease and sin and hatefulness from his creation. That is the hope to which Christians look forward. And can I just give a little personal reflection on how God has come to us? If you aren't a Christian, you might find this a bit strange, but for those of us who are Christians, one of the most precious times we go through is to celebrate the Lord's Supper. A precious, a wonderful time when we take bread and wine, because Jesus said, "This is my body, bread. This is my blood, wine." And you could ask yourself, why did Jesus use those symbols of himself? Luther, my hero Luther, got it all wrong. He was too close to the Catholics. I hope you aren't a Catholic. Excuse me if I'm a bit polemic here. But that was biblical literalism, the transubstantiation and consubstantiation. They said, if Jesus said, "This is my body," then he means this is my body. But I don't believe he did. He is holding up bread and wine as representations of himself. I could show you a picture of my family, my beautiful wife and two lovely grown-up kids, and say, "These are mine. This is my family." And you would say, "Don't be silly. They are a two-dimensional piece of cardboard this big. They are this big, and my wife's that big and cuddly. You know, what do you mean?" I say, when I show you this photo, it's a representation that you can see the key features, which say, "Well, you've got lovely kids, and that's your wife. Oh, great." When Jesus said, "This is my body, and this is my blood," he was holding up a photo, which were representations. Now, why should they be likenesses of Jesus? And I would suggest, I don't know whether this is idiosyncratic or whether poo-hoo or equivalent, but life comes from grain. Life and energy and sweetness comes from the grain. And both need to be crushed. Wheat needs to be milled, or at least chewed, ground, before it passes its life onto us. And grapes need to be squashed, pulverized, before the juice runs out and you can get wine. And Jesus was saying, perhaps, look, when you think of me, this is the closest you get. I don't want other images. This is the closest you get. This is my body, pulverized like grain. This is my blood, poured out like a squashed grain. This is a symbol of God's kenotic, self-giving, others-empowering love, which we encounter at the cross. We're God in Christ. Took our sin and the pain and suffering of the world upon himself. I think it's very significant in Luke's Gospel, where Jesus was having dinner with two disciples after the resurrection, and they didn't recognize him. And then when Jesus broke bread, when he pulled out his photograph, it says, then their eyes were opened, and they saw the Lord. In that symbol of life given through pulverization, the disciples recognized Jesus. And in our lives, however they may be affected by grief and sickness and failure, we can be confident in the presence of the suffering God with us. Dying, not just in empathy, but to release us.
Here's my last one.
Curly comes to this and says, what we really need, it's all very well to say that God suffers. We need an eschatological doctrine of providence. God's providence, God's care for his creation, God's relation to his creation only makes sense in the light of what will happen. And here is the Christian's ultimate hope. Creation is incomplete. Our confession of God's omnipotence assures us that he will not abandon our chaotic history, but guides it to its destination. Yes, there will be consolation. Yes, there will be restoration. There will be reconciliation. There will be freedom from the devil's abundance that tie us down. God has promised that he has not only suffered alongside us, but that his suffering will bring an end to this world of pain and grief.
The Bible promises that there will come a time in the future when God will reign over all things. And then nothing will happen without his will. Then he will be all in all. Then it will be heaven on earth. Then the traditional doctrine of providence will at last come true. And that will be on the new earth, the new heavens and the new earth, where righteousness will be at home.
Thank you for listening. God bless you.